by the end of 2025, the long end of the interest rate curve, which central banks cannot control, will be rising. The yields will be rising very sharply. For instance, we have 10-year treasuries yielding well over 10%. That will result in the highly leveraged parts of the global economy basically going bust, which will lead us into the coming depression.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. The last time today's guest expert was on this channel, he predicted a rocky road ahead for the global economy, one that will eventually culminate in the massive pile of trillions of dollars worth of global unserviceable debt going into default and thus causing a worldwide depression by 2025. Since his last appearance, the markets have become a lot more optimistic. U.S. GDP has perked up a bit, and inflation has been marching downwards, albeit more slowly than the central banks would like. Today, we'll ask copper expert and macro analyst Simon Hunt whether his dire forecast has improved at all, or perhaps gotten even worse. Simon, thanks so much for joining us today, all the way from Dubai.
That's right.
I appreciate you staying up late. I know it's late there, your time.
No, that's for you, no problem at all.
You're such a gentleman. All right, look, well, let's bang through all this efficiently so that you can get to bed at a decent hour tonight. Let's start with the question that I ask you to kick the discussions off every time you come on this channel. Simon, what's your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
I think we have a false dawn. I think that as we look out to 2025, 2026, we will basically see three phases of ups and downs. Between now and the middle of the year, we will have a very large correction in global equity, bond, and commodity markets. This will force the Fed and other central banks to ease monetary policy, produce a form of QE, and rates will start falling. That will result in a resurgence of inflation, particularly energy and food prices. The dollar will start falling sharply. With inflation rising, equity and commodity markets will surge to new highs by the end of 2025. But at the same time, the long end of the interest rate curve, which central banks cannot control, will be rising. The yields will be rising very sharply. For instance, we have 10-year treasuries yielding well over 10%. That will result in the highly leveraged parts of the global economy basically going bust, which will lead us into the coming depression.
Okay, all right. So sounds like from the last time you were on, the overall arc still sort of remains the same, where yeah, we have this short-term weakness that forces the hands of the central banks. Their actions kind of goose asset prices, except they also dramatically goose yields. And basically it's the weight of those higher yields on the overleveraged global system that basically kind of break everything and bring us into what you're calling a global depression with a D.
Yeah, correct. I think there is an additional factor that we have to add to the fragility of the global economic and financial structure, and that is the war syndrome. The war has been perceived by markets as something way out, far away from America, doesn't concern us, etc., etc. But the war is going to, probably by the middle of this year, is going to take on a completely different posture, which is basically whether you call it World War III, I'm not sure. Though in my gut, it's saying it's going to be World War III. Because what's at stake for Russia is the security of its borders, which NATO members ever since 1991 have failed to keep their promises. So, and it's particularly relevant for Russia in an age of hypersonic technology, whereby probably within 2 to 3 years, America will have mastered that technology and will be in a position to locate hypersonic missiles close to Russia's borders, which would enable them to hit the big cities within 3 to 4 minutes. For America, what is at stake is really the breaking up of the growing alliance that was taking place between Germany, Russia, and China. Had that progressed, it would have led to the three countries controlling Eurasia, which, if you go back to 1904, to Halford Mackinder's treatise, he who controls the heartland, which is Eurasia, controls the world. So the first part of what's been taking place from America's point of view is the breakup of that alliance, which they've successfully done.
And is that, so what's interesting is this might be one of the first times that viewers are hearing of this sort of concept. I think most people know that Russia and China have been cozying up to each other more of late, and that the West's response to the Russian invasion of Ukraine has probably only pushed them a little bit closer together. But the fact that you're kind of pairing Germany in with those three may be new to a lot of viewers here. So I guess two questions. One, how long had the German component of that been in play leading up until recently? And I imagine you think the destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline was to somehow, you know, separate Germany and Russia.
Yeah, it was to break that.
And was that an effective tactic in splintering that relationship?
Yes. So how long has that triangular relationship been occurring? Was that the question?
Yeah, exactly. I'm just not sure too many people, at least, I wasn't aware that Germany was playing in that angle.
Goes back a very long way. I would say it goes back to when the Berlin Wall fell. And I've forgotten the date, but that's early 1990s.
All right. And so obviously Germany and Russia were trading partners. Germany was getting an increasing amount of its energy from Russia. And is the theory that America started realizing, oh my gosh, if there's a component in Europe, Russia, and then China all working together, they then control the heartland, as you're saying here. And that becomes a block that we just, that's too much power for us to, it tips the scales of the global
power structure too much. So basically it threatens America's hegemony, would threaten the domination of the US dollar. So you've got your two sides deeply entrenched. Russia because of the security of its borders, and America, the dollar hegemony, because what's happening elsewhere in the world, the large part of the world has got fed up by being told what to do by America. And what you're seeing is the enlargement of BRICS Plus. I believe today Egypt has formally announced that they have joined BRICS Plus. We know that from both public statements and private conversations that the countries in the Gulf are going to join it. We know, for instance, that Saudi Arabia has sold some oil to China, which China paid for in RMB. And with those RMB, Saudi Arabia bought gold, probably on the Shanghai Gold Exchange. Mm-hmm. So in my view, that was a test case. Does it work? And the answer is probably yes. I think gold is very central to the BRICS Plus equation. I mean, as to give another example, the trade between Russia and China is growing exponentially, with Russia holding a large trade surplus. That trade surplus is held in a gold differential account with the PBOC. Yeah. So what the Russian economist who is running the financial side of BRICS Plus, developing their new trade and currency platforms, what's now going to happen is that member countries can trade within themselves or even externally eventually on a currency that's based on 20 commodities that they produce, but valued not in US dollars, but in grams of gold.
Okay, and you've mentioned this the previous times you've been on the program, as have analysts like monetary analysts like Alistair McLeod, who I know that you're in communication with. So it sounds like they're already kind of piloting this in certain ways. It's yes, perhaps not fully operational, and maybe it's not backed by all 20 commodities yet and whatnot, but they're already doing some currency deal, currency trade outside of US dollars is sort of resolved or at least backed by gold.
So you can see actually that when it comes to the Gulf countries, the same formula that China and Russia have formulated will probably be used when, or fairly, let's put it a different way, when the Gulf countries make the decision, which will be a step-by-step approach, to ditch the dollar and to use for their trade, other currencies than the dollar. Probably not other fiat currencies, and probably it will be, as Russia is holding a trade surplus in a gold differential account at the PBOC, so the same will probably happen with the Gulf countries.
Okay, and do we have a name for this new?
No, not yet. Not yet. I just call it the new currency.
Okay, we'll call it the new BRICS Plus currency, just for the sake of this conversation. And I do want to move into some, you know, from the sort of geopolitical into the economic in just a minute. But Simon, you are based in Dubai. You are a commodity expert. You've done trade with most of the countries that we're mentioning here. So you have a real sort of practical insider's view on really what the people in all those countries think. So you mentioned, you used the term ditch the dollar when the BRICS Plus coalition decides to ditch the dollar. You tell me, I'm assuming it's not going to be like one day a flip is switched and they're
no,
just saying,
it'll be step by step.
Right. So for a good while, perhaps, we'll sort of see competition in the world reserve currency space, right? So it's not like the dollar is necessarily going to lose all its trade business with these countries overnight, but they'll just progressively do less and less in dollars and more in the BRICS currency.
Until there will come a point when it could be literally a ditch. And I think that depends upon what happens in the war syndrome.
All right. So back to the war. So one quick question there. So if the Nord Stream pipeline was sabotaged to basically break the ties between Germany and Russia, sounds like you said that was pretty effective. You know, there's been a lot of recent allegations, the Seymour Hersh article, you know, basically saying, look, the U.S. did it and here are all the details. And I think that if you look at the list of suspects, even before the Hersh article came out, U.S. was probably near the top. I'm just curious, you know, the risk there is that it could backfire, where Germany could say, hey, you know, you just intervened in a, you know, our national sovereignty and, you know, could create a backlash against U.S.-Germany ties. I don't necessarily see that that's happened, but I'm not a geopolitical analyst here. What do you see as the fallout from that?
I think, let's put it this way, I think there is, not immediately, but over the next couple of years, I think there's a real risk that we'll have a change of government in Germany, that the German industrialists will have a larger say in the formation of policy, and that where do they see growth over the next 10, 20 years? Not westwards, but eastwards. And I think you can well see that Germany will rebuild that alliance with Russia and China, depending, of course, on how the war ends. And then you have to ask the question, does that then mean that they join BRICS Plus?
I was going to say, would you have a Germexit? You know, would Germany break out of the EU?
That's another question. I think it leads to the breakup of the EU. I think there's a huge risk that that will happen.
I think we could have even debated that the sustainability of the EU as a political and certainly as a monetary structure, separate the whole war issue. But obviously, you throw a lot more into the mix when you have this new triangle you're talking
about
here.
Absolutely. But the war is causing this rethinking.
Okay. Well, look, this is super fascinating and germane, right? I mean, you're saying, look, the war is really going to drive a lot of decision-making about what happens.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
The war sits over everything else. You have a fragile financial world. And then on top of that, you've got the war. And the war is not going to end tomorrow.
Right. And even if it does, you know, let's presume for a moment it doesn't escalate further from here. And that hopefully at some point there's some peacefully negotiated settlement. It has sort of divided the world into this much more of a bipolar scenario.
Yes.
Right. So now it's Team America, right? America and its Western buddies, and it's sort of BRICS Plus, which is what you're talking
Correct.
About here.
Correct.
Let's say that does continue to be the way the world works going forward. And this BRICS Plus coalition really does gel, and they create this new currency that you've mentioned that is sort of underpinned by gold. I mean, 20 commodities, but gold is what it's being priced in. What does that do to the price of gold from here? Like, what's your outlook on gold?
Positive. What is going to be the price? Who knows? But I think over the next 2 years, we'll see $3,000. Don't forget that the Chinese public own approximately 23,000 tons of gold, which they have bought off the Shanghai Gold Exchange since its formation. And that probably the Chinese government owns another, do my maths, 30-odd thousand tons, mostly held in different ministries, including the PLA. And in fact, to give a little insight into that, I used to have a very close Japanese business friend whose company got about 40% of its revenues from China. And as he said to me over lunch, I have to know very many different people in China, one of whom is a senior general, who invited me down to drinks at headquarters, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. 2 hours later, he tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Let's walk across the compound," which we did. And we came to this huge warehouse. And when the doors were opened, my jaws dropped, because there, stacked from floor to ceiling, were bars of gold. Just to show you that it's not just the central bank that owns the gold in China. And on the same note, Russia's real holdings of gold are not what's being held by its central bank, but by the company that controls the central bank. And their total gold holdings are around 12,000 tons.
Okay, so we're putting all that together, China plus Russia, that's almost like 75,000 tons of gold.
Something like that, yeah.
Something like that, yeah.
Big, which is big, broad numbers.
Which I believe, and I'm doing this from memory, but that is much higher, I believe, than sort of what's reported in terms of sovereign gold holdings.
Way higher, way higher.
Yeah. So it's sort of like, I'm going to make a bad analogy here. The old Star Wars movies, the Empire was building this Death Star that nobody knew about until it was actually fully operational, and they sort of sprung it on the galaxy. You're sort of saying, in some ways, you know, there's all this work behind the scenes to create this system that's backed by gold, but they're not going to let anybody know about it until bang, it's there.
Yes, yeah. And you'll get to the Big Bang, as it were, in a step-by-step approach by countries trading between themselves outside the dollar. And in fact,
which you said we're already beginning to see, and very prominently Saudi Arabia has just started.
Now with Egypt, they will be able to tap into the BRICS bank, which I've forgotten the name. And that bank will allow them to trade without the dollar. So this is a huge benefit to Egypt. It doesn't have to build a reserve of dollars to finance its imports. That's going to happen right across BRICS Plus.
All right, and then to To murder my analogies here. So in Star Wars, the second movie was The Empire Strikes Back, right? You know, Team America is probably not just going to let this happen lying down, you know, sort of ceding its dominance as the right now, you know, pretty much only world reserve currency. What tactics do you expect from the West, from Team America, to try to throw sand in the gears of this new BRICS Plus currency?
I have to say war.
Okay, so it's saber rattling, you know, it's, threat of war.
Yeah. I mean, look at America's just negotiated 4 additional military bases in the Philippines. I hear that America is deploying more troops to Japan and Guam. There is this continuous encirclement. You've got one of the top Pentagon guys now in Taipei, or on his way there. You had the other day the American embassy in Moscow advising all Americans to leave Russia. You had today at Putin's annual speech saying that we are temporarily withdrawing from the New START treaty and that we have placed ground-based strategic missiles, nuclear weapons on combat duty. It's all hotting up. Whether it's going to lead to anything, who knows? But it's that all one can say is the tensions are going to increase.
Okay.
And that's going to have a huge impact on monetary policy.
Okay, let's use that as the bridge to get to the macro side of things. So when you say huge impact on monetary policy, any particular manifestation that you have in mind when you say that?
Yeah, you go from QT to QE in some form or another. Interest rates will start falling. Inflation then takes off. Energy prices will, you probably see some further supply disruptions, plus the fact that OPEC is no longer going to do the bidding of America and Europe, but will follow policies that reflect the real supply demand situation. Plus, we're bound to get some supply disruptions. So we have oil prices this year probably at 150 before the end of the year, and between 150 and 200 next year. Food prices will also be soaring, not only because of the war, but because of weather patterns. In particular, there is a risk that either this year or next year, that the 89-year Glesberg cycle hits again. And 89 years ago, it caused the American Midwest Dust Bowl decade. So there are many reasons for seeing that in the drop in inflation is very transitory. And that by the time we get into 2025, probably the US CPI, despite all the manipulations that are and have been taking place, will probably be higher than the 1980 peak of 13.5%.
Okay, so so you're saying, hey, if you didn't like the inflation we saw, you know, 2021 through 2022, you ain't seen nothing yet.
That's right. But that's exactly what you saw in the 1970s and the early 1980s. You had the first wave. And then by the time you got into 78, 79, and 80, you got the second wave, which was the destructive wave.
Right. And of course,
and as events these days speed up, you're not going to wait for 4 or 5 years.
Right. And what's interesting is you know, Chairman Powell and Christine Lagarde at the ECB and many other central bank heads are saying, well, we're not going to repeat those sins of the 70s. We're going to be super committed. We're going to be super resolute. You're thinking, nope, they're going to fold here because of the large correction and I guess recession, the global recession with an R that we'll see this year.
Yeah, correct.
Okay. And obviously all the war stuff.
Too many dead bodies lying around the financial system.
Okay. So that's the something too important breaks. They have to step in to rescue.
Yeah.
They do. Inflation then, you know, goes off to the races, ultimately racing up above 13.5%. You know, you're making some bold calls that aren't that far away, you know, $200 oil, you know, food shortages, perhaps. So things just get more expensive, more scarce. And I guess this is the question I had for you is the central banks will be easing. So they'll be pushing down the short-term yields on sovereign debt. But because of all the instability, I imagine, that's when the bond market kind of gives up, loses faith in the central planners and says, look, inflation's going off to the races. The system's getting a lot more unstable.
Yep.
Give me higher yields to compensate. And that's what actually breaks everything.
Absolutely. That's why by 2026 and probably 2025, we have U.S. treasuries, 10-year treasuries yielding over 10%.
Okay. So we go from global recession later this year, you're calling for, to central bank, the great central bank reinflation, rescue reinflation that doesn't really rescue the system. And then that topples over into the global depression that you see arriving by 2025, 2026.
Yep.
Okay.
Probably 2025. Might even be the end of 2024.
Okay, well, so you're bringing in a little bit. So I'm curious, Simon, because I've now had you on a couple of times, you know, roughly 6 months ago and then 6 months before that. Now that you're here, down the timeline a bit, do you find yourself pushing the timeline off a little bit for all this or pulling it in? It sounds to me like you're pulling it in maybe a little bit.
If anything, pulling it in a bit.
Okay.
And I think that's a function of war.
Got it. Which was the new element last time you and I talked. And of course, as you predicted then, it wasn't going to blow over quickly, and it certainly hasn't. All right, let's see here. What haven't we talked about? Yeah, we fit almost everything on here. I guess in the short term, you've said you expect the US dollar to like drop down to kiss 100. Then go back up to about 110 by mid-year. But then it begins its long-term decline. Is that sort of still your outlook?
Yeah. And I think the recovery to 110 is probably a function of the war becoming much fiercer, and you get a rush of typical rush of buying out of other currencies into the dollar.
It's a crisis trade. People are just fearful.
Yeah, supposedly safe haven. Yeah. Supposedly.
Okay. And of course, that has, you know, big dollar moves have big repercussions. We saw that a lot last year. You, from an investor standpoint, maybe let's trundle over here now. So, you know, what do you think will happen to the markets in all of this? And, having listened to you and having read some of your recent works, it sounds like you think in the very near term. So we got very near term, S&P could spike here while the markets are still probably more optimistic than they should be, given everything you've just mentioned. Get as high as maybe 4,300. You then expect it to get knocked down with the arrival of the recession and everything we've mentioned to about 3,000 by mid-2023.
Correct.
And then it sounds like you think it'll hit new highs.
Which will also mean commodities as well.
Commodities as well. Yes, mid-year kind of everything gets
big
battered.
fall in equity markets will shake out the weak holders.
Got it. Got it. And presumably kind of everything would go down, right? Equities, bonds would go down, except maybe for treasuries, long-term treasuries, that might be the safety trade, right? Commodities will go down, like you said. So that gets us to the arrival of the recession part of 2023. Then we have
Correct.
the reinflation rescue. Sounds like I think I heard you say that stocks and commodities will hit new highs during that period, probably
Correct,
because of all the liquidity
correct,
and yep.
correct,
All right. But
So you
then, so we get to
basically, in very broad numbers, the S&P will double in value by 2026. Copper
okay.
will go from, say, 6,500 to 14,000. Oil,
Okay.
we've already spoken about.
Yep. So when we get to so that surprises me only slightly, where I thought you would have thought that they would have had some massive high like that, like a doubling, but then would have rolled over when the depression hit. Are they just that high in 2026 because the dollar has been so weakened at that point?
Well, if you take the metals industry or take copper as an example, what we have seen and are still seeing is inventories of everything, components, products, copper itself being depleted because of order books. So the recovery comes in. So they replenish those order books. And with the dollar falling, inflation rising, they will then add to their normal inventories. And that is a huge shift. It's a massive shift. Anything from 500,000 tons to 800,000 tons. And it's the same for all the metals. So that's why the recovery plus inflation will have such a dramatic impact on the metals industry.
Okay. And I understand that. I'm thinking about just sort of general equities still remaining up at a doubling by the global depression. And I guess the reason why I'm harping on this is people who are, saying, okay, Simon's arc makes sense to me. Oh, well, if he thinks that the stock market's going to double and hang out there, maybe that's a place where I'll keep my money. I don't necessarily think you're saying that, but correct me if I'm wrong.
I think we have the correction. And in the correction, that is the time when you reinvest your money.
Okay. And so let me
And
just ask
what
this
you're
one last.
saying is a lot of people will say, well, if it's going to double, even if it goes down to 3,000, I will still hold on. I think I mean, I'm not an equity expert, but yeah, you get some who say that and others who get shaken out.
Yeah. Well, let me ask this question one different way, which is we have the rescue reflation, right, which picks the S&P up, and we're just totally prognosticating here. So we'll have you back
Yeah,
on
yeah, yeah, yeah,
long
yeah.
before to clarify. But we get knocked down to 3,000 over the next couple years, goes up to
Correct.
6,000, right?
Yeah.
When the depression hits, do you see the markets coming down
Oh,
because of
crashing,
that? Pardon me?
crashing,
Crashing.
crashing.
Okay, good. That's all I wanted to know. Okay, so you do expect a market crash sort of
Yeah.
by the end of 2026 or
Yeah.
someplace like that.
So the recovery over the next 2 years should be used to save you during the depression.
Great. Okay. So that's your opportunity basically to,
That's
yeah,
your
to
opportunity, exactly.
ride the escalator before it turns into a falling elevator.
Yeah. Don't be the last guy on the dance floor.
Okay. All right. So let's see here. Let's talk about this depression. And we're getting near the end of the discussion here, and I hate to end on a depression, but maybe there's something after, right? So we get this global depression that you're forecasting, and it's largely due at that point to interest rates, yields just being so high that are highly leveraged global economy and financial, you know, it's a hugely financialized economy now, just breaks under it all, right? And it sends us into a depression. Obviously, that's going to be a painful period for anybody going through it. Is there a sunrise that happens after that?
Yes, you know? On our work, very much so. First of all, when the crash comes, is probably the moment when BRICS Plus introduce their new currency and trading platform. Always introduce these things in a period of crisis.
Crisis, right. Oh, hey, there's an alternative, folks. Jump on board. Yeah.
That's that. But secondly, what's the depression going to do? It's going to wash out the debt. So we will then probably evolve a system which is much more equity-based and not debt-based. And then we will see from our work, both global GDP has operated in about 40-year long cycles. We ended the last cycle in 2020, which was a negative 40-year period. So we're going to go back into a positive 40-year period, but it's first interrupted by the depression. So global GDP has averaged a growth rate of just under 4% since 1900. We'll revert back to that sort of level after the depression.
Okay. So, you know, in many ways, this is sort of the Austrian economists.
Yeah, it's a cleaning up process.
It's the cleansing cycle, right? All the malinvestment gets cleared. Yeah. So I should have asked this earlier, and I'm going to tie this to another question in a second, but this BRICS Plus currency that you've been mentioning, you wouldn't call that a fiat currency, would you?
No, because it's gold-based.
Okay, so there are some controls on its expansion, right? It's
gold based.
Yeah. So we very well maybe. So let me ask you this: the Team America, the West's response over time, maybe, especially if we get this sort of collapse you're talking about, is hey, maybe we need to revert to a non-fiat based currency as well, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I think that's what will happen.
Okay. And so that may, you know, pave the way for a more equitable monetary system.
Then the two sides can come together. Because really what the issue is to negotiate spheres of interest between BRICS Plus and the Western Alliance. But until you've got all the nasties out of their systems by the war, then they can come together to negotiate these spheres of interest.
Right. And just like markets like stability and predictability, global economies do the same. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And sort of what I'm, you know, even thinking about here too is we can perhaps lay the a good chunk of the reason for the over-financialization of the current world economy is that we have all these debt-based fiat monetary systems driving the world right now.
Yeah. Right.
Because of the way these systems are structured, that money is borrowed into existence, just debt and credit have to multiply as these systems run.
Yeah.
If we revert to something that doesn't do that, then we don't have to be doomed to the same destiny.
Exactly.
All right. Well, Simon, it's, as always, just been fascinating to have you on for this conversation. We will continue to bring you back on to, chronicle for us where we are in this progression. And if anything, you know, happens that changes your outlook one way or the other beforehand, please let me know. We'll bring you on sooner.
Sure.
So your videos have been some of the most watched ones on Wealthion in its history here. No, no surprise why. For folks that have really enjoy your analysis, and maybe for folks, this video might be the first time they're getting exposed to you, where can they go to follow you in your work?
Simon-hunt.com.
Great. And what will they find there?
There you'll find my website, and there you'll find we're starting a monthly newsletter, well priced, and they can access it on the website.
Okay, fantastic. So when we edit this, Simon, we'll put up the URL to
Thank you.
Simon-hunt.com.
Yeah.
Great. And anyone who's interested can go there, look at your newsletter. I get Simon's existing newsletter. Actually, multiple copies of it helped me put together the question list for this this video. Highly, highly recommended. All right, Simon. Well, look, again, been just a honor, pleasure. Love to have you coming back on the channel here in the future. Just in wrapping up for folks, I want to mention a couple quick resources. One is don't forget that Wealthy on Spring Conference is coming up next month on Saturday, March 18th. If you can't watch the event live, don't worry. Replay videos of all the presentations and all the Q&A sessions will be sent to everybody who registers. To register and find out more about the event and to lock in the early bird price discount, which is still in effect, go to wealthion.com/conference. And if you've enjoyed having Simon on this channel, would like to see him come back on again in the future, as well as other great minds like him, please support this channel by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Simon, thanks so much, buddy. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you very much. Always enjoyed it with you.
Thanks,
Cheers.
Simon. Everybody else, thanks so much for
Time for
watching.
a drink.
Agreed. All right, take care.
Cheers.